Okay, I think we'll begin. Welcome to... we all ready? Welcome to week three. Just wanted to mention and to remind everyone that it's a short term, this one, so we actually, besides today, we're going to do another 2 weeks. The term goes on for one more week, but I'm going to be away that last week, so another 2 weeks. In other words, we end on the 5th of December. Time is flying. And then we take a summer break. Okay. So just a bit of review from last week and where we're up to so far. So we're working through this book. It's within you, which is using the model of trying to develop a lifestyle where we work inside out. We use an inside-out formula rather than an outside-in, which we explain just very briefly to get everyone up to date, that the fundamental of a need of a person is to have a sense of self-worth, but it all depends where that self-worth comes from. So we talked about tapping into our inner self-worth, which comes from inside, in our intrinsic value, our soul essentially. That's the within model, but the without model, the outwards-in model, is the one where we acknowledge or confirm our worthiness and our sense of value coming from the perception of the outside world or the outside layers, the superficiality of ourselves. Essentially, the outside-in model is one where everything on the outside determines my self-worth, whereas the inside-out model is that my inner worth determines my reality outside. So that's very, very different. And we'll be working on that. So we explained it a bit 2 weeks ago. Last week, right, this was the model we did yesterday. Last week we talked about that if that's the concept and if we understand it in our mind and we have the mindset, it's not so easy to feel that way. And therefore the pathway to feeling that way is to engage in action. So we re-examined the principle of Achrei HaMaasim Mishach HaLevavot, that the heart follows the behavior. So that if we can identify certain behaviors that are behaviors that are consistent with an outside-in model and then stay away from them and engage in behaviors which is more an inside-out model, then we'll start to actually feel that way. It's a process, it's a journey. Of course, we never start as one or the other. It's moving along towards the destination because reaching it at a perfect level is very difficult, but at least we can identify some of the stuff and at least move towards that concept of feeling and acknowledging our worthiness and our self-value from the inside rather than from the outside. So we talked about the concept of hiding. So the author of the book, Rabbi, I've forgotten his name now. Oh, Rabbi Weinstein. yes, exactly. He says that one classic tactic which we subconsciously use to gain a sense of worthiness from the outside is the concept of hiding, where we're not honest, we're not present, and we're hiding parts of ourselves because we're worried that if we reveal and we're present with all of us, that we will create a wrong impression from someone else on the outside. So the examples he gave was, like, we lie, so we say, oh, not so lie, oh, outrightly, but we say things like, I'll be home in 15 minutes, or you know it's going to be half an hour, but you're just scared to get the other person upset, or we're not honest in our conversations, and so on and so forth. So we talked about the concept of being honest and coming clean, even sometimes honestly admitting the failures and weaknesses that we have, although it seems very risky if we use an outside-in model because we're worried about the impression of other people. But the truth is that it creates a presence, it creates a connection, it creates a strength of ourselves and it creates a strength for ourselves and in our relationships. So like, for example, if someone tells us something, we don't become defensive. We listen to them. We're able to acknowledge that we might have been wrong without getting angry. We're able to discuss it and so on and so forth. And he came up with this formula and he said that when we hide, we're always looking for something, always looking and seeking, whether when we show up, we're actually finding, right? And we ended off last week by just making the point that being honest does not mean being tactless. Right? Not every time we have to say everything that's on our mind. We need to We need to be tactless, we need to be respectful of others, but at the same time we have to pursue the concept of being present and being honest and not hiding, because remembering that even if we are somewhat vulnerable, our worthiness doesn't come from our failures, our worthiness doesn't come from our deficiencies, our worthiness comes from inside. Okay. He also talked about some of the hiding tactics, like lying, exaggeration, flattering, seeking praise, being a victim is the opposite sort of part of the formula, and so on. Now today we're going to talk about a very important thing. Today we're going to have a look at another behavior, I should say, that if we can identify a specific strategy, a specific behavior, meaning it's really a whole concept, but we're going to try and minimize it sort of, or capitalize it in a kind of a behavior, right? Which will be another type of behavior that causes us to switch from that outside-in model rather than the inside-out model. In other words, it's a behavior that if we engage in that behavior, what we'll see is often behaving the way I'm going to describe it comes because we live an inside-out model, but it can work the other way around. If we're a type of person, which we all are to some extent, where our worthiness comes from the outside, the way to move away from that is, as we said last week, to identify behaviors. But the behavior that we're going to talk about today is one that's really important, one that's very difficult, actually, but it's deeper. And it causes us in a much stronger way to shift from that outside-in model to an inside-out model, and to tap into our souls, tap into our intrinsic worth and our intrinsic value. And the behavior I'm talking about, in a nutshell, we're going to unpack it and describe it and explain it properly, is the concept of self-control and self-restraint. Easy? Right? Yeah. Okay. So, we're going to do it in two parts, but let's just try and give a bit of an introduction. The author in the book, what I'm going to draw on today is really two chapters of the book. One from Abba Weinstein, because remember he's co-authored this book with someone called Elaine Cohen, I think. So one chapter is from him, one chapter is from her, but essentially arrive at the same point. They talk about different angles of the same thing, but they arrive at the same idea, which I'm going to draw on and share with you some ideas. So in the chapter that he writes, the first thing he talks about is this concept of self-absorption. What I mean by that is people who, and sometimes it's all of us, that if we really took an honest look at ourselves and thought about, often in our interactions, when we interact with other people, when we interact with the world, who we worried about most. And often the answer is ourselves, right? If we're honest, that is. And what happens when we only worried about ourselves is, the analogy he gives is like a drowning person, right? A drowning person that's grasping for life, it's an interesting analogy actually, often does things that are detrimental to themselves. So the common analogy for this is that if you try and save a drowning person, often the drowning person will pull you down with them. The reason for this is because there's no rational thinking. They're totally absorbed in themselves, not understanding what is going on outside of them at all, not even understanding the things other people might be doing for their own benefit. And because they're so into themselves, legitimately in that case, they tend to do things that are actually going to be detrimental for themselves, right? So often we do that also. So we cause unhappiness, we cause emptiness, we do things that aren't effective because the process and the focus in our life experiences is ourselves. Now, shifting that, in order to shift that, one of the things we need to learn to do, which is directly connected to understanding our own self-worth, is move away from self-absorption, move away from taking ourselves so seriously, right? So what we'll see is that if we create a cycle, or if we begin a cycle, we initiate a cycle, where we're less consumed with ourselves, right? Then we feel less insecure, we feel less desperate, and we actually become stronger ourselves. It's almost an opposite. We don't always think away like that. But the point of this is that the less we think about ourselves, the less we take ourselves seriously in everything that we do, the stronger we become and the more effective we become, right? Now, let's just understand that. Now, we're not talking about not taking care of ourselves. Taking care of ourselves is an important thing. Maintaining emotional health is an important thing. We need to make sure we're never in danger. In our relationships, sometimes we have to create boundaries. All of that is true, right? The question is, what's the focus? Now, how does this all work? It works very simply because when we're self-absorbed, when our interest is ourselves, right? In other words, and when I talk about taking ourselves seriously, to use extreme analogy, these are the people that have tons of needs, like the high maintenance type of people. They're always needy for something. They're always worried about something, always hung up about something, always issued about something, right? Because it's always about them. I say that in the extreme because that's sort of, you know, I'm probably sitting here wondering about, you know, who you can identify, maybe more than one people you can personally identify as like that. But the truth is that we shouldn't be looking so much on the outside because we're all a bit like that to a degree, right? Because that's where we're born. We all have an ego. So the way it works is, the reason for that is because we're very insecure. Why are we very insecure? For the point we're making and we've made many times in the past. Because we tend to get our sense of worthiness from the outside. And therefore, we're terribly worried about protecting the fragility of who we are. And therefore, making sure that we are taken care of, making sure that everyone's thinking positively about me, making sure that everyone is surrounding me, everything is centered around me, because I'm protecting the me all the time, because I don't understand or I'm not tapping into, I don't acknowledge the intrinsic self-worth that I have that would allow me not to do that, right? So essentially what happens is like this. Just to summarize this point. The outside-in model, in other words, the model of self-worth that comes from the outside, results in egocentricity, right? That's very simple. Because everything's coming from the outside, therefore my own self-worth is non-existent, therefore my existence is very fragile, very insecure, and therefore the insecurity results in arrogance, because as we've talked about many times, arrogance is a form of insecurity. The insecurity results in protecting myself all the time and therefore minimizes, right? This is the really important thing, minimizes the opportunity to see other people, to gain from other people, to learn from other people, to learn from other experiences, to expand my perspectives, to be objective, to be able to expand and to learn from all the experiences and the people that are around me because I'm too absorbed in myself and therefore I become weaker. So the focus on myself makes me not stronger, makes me a lot weaker. Whereas the inside-out model, if I live a life where my self-worth is taken from the inside, from my intrinsic worth, my intrinsic value, I care less about myself. I'm not so focused on myself. I'm not so absorbed in myself. I'm actually less absorbed in myself. I don't take myself that seriously, which allows me to connect to the outside. It allows me to learn from the outside. It allows me to expand into the outside and to see other perspectives, to see other values, to see other experiences and to learn from them and to grow. When I was growing up, one of the things my mother always used to say is an expression that she had, if we go to hear someone talk and it was very obvious that the person was very full of themselves, I'd say to my mother, what do you think about the speech? She would say, oh, the person's a very big eye specialist. That was a very... Now, of course, this is linked to a story that I've shared with you many times, right? A story where, but it encapsulates the whole idea. It's a story which took place with a Hasidic Rebbe called the Tzemach Tzedek, where someone came to him and he complained, one of his Hasidim, one of his followers, he said to him in Yiddish, Metretaf mir in the Beis Medrash, which means everyone's stepping on me in the shul, wherever I go, people are trampling on me. So the Tzemach Tzedek answered him and said, who told you to spread yourself out so big? Right? If you wouldn't spread yourself in the whole shul, no one would step on you. But obviously the concept is that you're spreading yourself out so widely because you're so insecure. And therefore you have this need to put yourself everywhere, to mix into everything, to make sure that you are the center of every conversation, of every experience. And therefore, people end up trampling on you because that's the outcome. The outcome is you become weaker. You become more insecure. Insecurity breeds insecurity. Arrogance breeds more arrogance because it's all the same thing. It's all that insecure fight to protect oneself, right? But if you were what we call in the Hasidic terminology, if you had more bittul, which means you had more what we call healthy self-negation, which is humility, which is not putting yourself in every experience, which is not being everywhere in the center of everything, but actually being more within yourself in a good way, in a healthy way, and understanding your own self-worth and just being there to listen to others, to connect to others, to make space for others, then you wouldn't be spreading yourself out. People wouldn't trample on you. On the contrary, you'd be within yourself, happy with yourself, comfortable with yourself, learning, therefore, from other people because you're not so focused on yourself. When we do this, we become, right? So this is how it works. The last part of the formula is this, that when outside in leads to ego and self-absorption, then also what it leads to is a life of emptiness. Because as we'll see later, all we do then is pursue things that are good for me now, things that make me feel good now, because my focus in life is myself. And therefore, it doesn't allow me to live a life of meaning, to live a life of depth. On the contrary, but when we talk about it inside out, which breeds humility and selflessness, because I don't need to be part of everything, actually what that allows me to do, besides learning from others and explaining to others, allows me to give also, and allows me to leave myself and to pursue something higher, to pursue a higher purpose and a deeper journey in life, right? So purpose versus emptiness, or purpose versus pursuit of pleasure, is very much linked to this, and we're going to see this play out in a minute, how important this is, right? One of the ways that we exercise this concept of not being self-absorbed, not taking ourselves so seriously, and learning from others, is also the ability to be objective. The ability to see things which we didn't see initially. To see another point of view. So in the author of the book, he brings, maybe it's a famous thing, but he brings this beautiful analogy, right? This beautiful experiment. I don't know if you've ever seen this. You ever seen this picture? It's called Shepherd's Tables or something. Shepherd's Rotator Tables. Now, I did the same thing. If I ask you which one is longer, you will tell me the left one, right? Well, you won't, because you think, because I've asked a trick question, right? But honestly, which one do you think is longer, right? Okay, and it's not. Did you know it's not? I tested it. The one on the right is as long. If you rotated the one on the right, if you took a piece of paper and measured the left side of the left one, and then you put it on the long side of the one, it's exactly the same size, right? And your eyes won't see it. And that's a symbol of life. There are certain things that we look at things and our eyes don't see it. Why? Because we look through our own eyes. Okay. When we leave ourselves a little bit, and we're able to go beyond ourselves a little bit, then we're able to see things that our eyes don't see. Because we're able to see things through the eyes of other people, or through the eyes of something higher than us, or through the eyes of God for that matter. Through learning Torah and being connected to who we really are in terms of our Jewish heritage, right? But we're not able to do that. That's, and I've told you this many times, that's why the Talmud says an amazing thing. It's worth repeating because it's such a powerful word, powerful sentence. The Talmud discusses, a piece in the Talmud where in great detail the Talmud discusses arrogance. Sorry. That's okay. And the Talmud says that God speaks about arrogance, and he says that when it comes to arrogance, if someone is a Baal Gaiva, as they call it in the Talmud, someone is an arrogant person, an ego, a person full of ego, Ein ani v'hu yicholin ladur, says God, I cannot coexist with such a person. I cannot tolerate such a person. Which is an amazingly powerful sentence, because God can tolerate anything. First, it was infinite. And not only, there are other verses where God says he's compassionate, he's forgiving, he's merciful, he'll live with the impure, the sinner, the everything, which is the concept of Shiva, right? And yet one thing he's not prepared to tolerate, and that's arrogance. And the answer is very, very simple, because God can only coexist with someone that lets him in. If a person is humble, you're full of mistakes, full of failures, full of sins even. God says, if you invite me in, I'm there with you. I'll help you. I'll help you repair. I'll help you repent. I'll help you return. I'll help you reconnect. I'll help you improve your life, and so on. But if you don't let me in, I can't. So there's one thing, that's one thing God says I cannot tolerate, that, and that's arrogance, because the person doesn't let me in. I don't go when I'm uninvited, right? Because if we're absorbed in ourselves, we don't see beyond ourselves. If we're absorbed in ourselves, we cannot even entertain the fact that the two tables are the same size, because our eyes don't see it. If we leave ourselves a little bit, we're able to see things through the eyes of others. Now, I'm just building up this case for the behavior, which I'm going to get to in a minute. Okay. These two perceptions, meaning the two ways of living, the outside-in model where we get our self-worth from others and we're a fragile self and insecure, leading to arrogance and emptiness, versus the mindset of, no, my self-worth comes from within me. Right? Those two mindsets, where do they live? They live in the consciousness of the person. Okay? That's how we think. But they're not driven by the consciousness of the person. This is the important thing I'm going to get to now. Right. So the way it works is like this. Both perceptions live in the consciousness of the human being. It's how we think about ourselves, right? Perception of ourselves in our mind, in our consciousness. However, the perception which is the outside-in perception lives in our consciousness, but is much more emotional. It's how we feel more about ourselves, more than how we understand ourselves. Obviously, it lives in our mind, but it's more how we feel about ourselves. We feel insecure. We feel our worth coming from others. Switching that, going to the inside-out model, means that we have to actually use more the power of intellect, the power of thinking. Because naturally, most of us don't actually acknowledge our self-worth and our intrinsic value. Most people are very worried about what the rest of the world thinks about them, right? Except for a few very natural, humble people that are born. But most of us have an ego, at least at some level. And therefore, most of us are actually housing a perception of ourselves in our mind, which is much more emotional than it is intellectual. It's much more subjective than it is objective. Right? Switching that means we need to switch to a perception which is much more intellect-based. It's much more objectively based. Where we understand that although I might feel that you're threatening me, which is why we don't like criticism, for example, but I know that's not true. I know that you don't determine my self-worth. You don't determine who I really am. My intrinsic value, my pure spark of my soul is what determines and creates my inner value and my self-worth. Right? Okay. So both things are in the consciousness of the mind. One is more emotional, one is more intellectual. However, they don't begin in the consciousness of the mind. This is the important thing. We've done this before, but I need to revisit this so we can get to what we want to get to today. Right? It doesn't begin in the consciousness of the mind because our whole being doesn't begin with our consciousness. Because beyond our consciousness is our subconscious. And we need to examine what is going on in our subconscious, right? Who's living in our subconscious? We kind of have an idea of who's living in our conscious, and we can talk about it. We can understand that in our conscious, we have our mind, we have our heart. There are things that we feel subjectively, there are things we feel objectively. We can understand the struggle between the two and so on and so forth. But we need to go deeper than that, and we need to examine who is living in our subconscious. And who's living in our subconscious is this. And just the way I want to bring it out is just by using a story that he brings in the book. The story is a story of the famous Reb Zusha. Reb Zusha was a great disciple of the Magid of Mizrich. He was a great Hasidic Rebbe. And he taught very important lessons in life. Like, for example, the one I was telling you about, the seven things to learn from a thief, comes from Reb Zusha. Many, many very powerful lessons come from Reb Zusha. And he had a very interesting way of teaching. And I guess he was a very, very great pious tzaddik. But on a very simple level, he was a master teacher. Because the way he brought out lessons often to his disciples was amazing. And one of the lessons that he taught came from a story where his disciples once found him alone, distraught, pacing his home, and repeating the sentence, "Where is Zusha? Where is Zusha?" So I guess some of them couldn't help thinking, doesn't look good. Looks like he's lost his mind. I mean, that's the normal behavior of someone that has lost their mind. But they waited for a moment it was Zusha after all. And can't question such a great Hasidic Rebbe. So they waited for a moment where things seemed to be calm and he seemed to be more focused and acting quite normally. And someone asked him, he says, "What was that all about?" So he said, "What do you mean?" It was a very legitimate question. He says, "We all have two parts to ourselves." The way the story is written in the book, but I'll just say it a bit differently, he says, we have our body and our soul, right? Just to translate a bit more focused and deeply is we have what we call our godly soul and our animal soul. Right, the animal soul is the drive that keeps our body, our physicality, ticking and existing and eating and sleeping and so on. And it's all the drives and the temptations that we have which come from our animalistic part, which is very focused and driven on our physical existence. That's one part of who we are. But then we have what we call the godly soul, the spark of godliness, the purity which drives us for a higher purpose, which is our soul essentially. It's what gives us meaning, what gives us purpose, what gives us a connection to God, what gives us a deeper living. He says, when I'm gone, when I pass away, or when people lose a loved one, they tend to say, this is what he responded to his disciples, he says, they tend to say, where is the person or the person that has left us? He says, but you're still going to see my body. What do you mean left us? Unless you're going to say that's not me. So who am I? It must be my soul. So he said, that's why you found me before walking around the house saying, where is Usha, where is Usha? I was trying to get to a point to understand and discover and connect to and acknowledge and really realize, who's the real me? Where is Usha? Who's the real Usha? Is just my physical existence together with my animal soul? Is that me? Well, if that's me, then when I'm gone, don't ask where I am, because I'll be right there. I'm still there. Ah, you're worried about where the soul of Usha is. So the soul is who I am, right? So in other words, like this, I bring in a story because that's exactly what happens on our subconscious. On our subconscious, what's driving our consciousness is problematic. Because what's driving our consciousness is our two souls. And our two souls work very, very differently. The animal soul works on the principle of ego, selfishness. What is good for me and pleasurable for me now, right? Our animal soul and our body, therefore, our physical existence, is focused on one thing. What is going to bring me a pain-free life now? What is going to bring me what I perceive to be worthiness now? What is going to be bring me what I call pleasure now? That's what the animal soul does, right? In other words, the animal soul and the body does not seek the truth. It just seeks what is going to be beneficial for me now. It's a very inward, self-absorbed process, right? That's our ego, and we all have it. That ego, on our subconscious, drives the consciousness to define our worthiness coming from the outside. Does that make sense? Right? The godly soul, on the other hand, is the other way around. Right? The godly soul is the spark of godliness, which is selfless. It is the spark within us which is, in fact, who we really are. It's our true value. It's our intrinsic worth. That part of our subconscious, that spark on the subconscious, is driving the consciousness to redefine our worthiness. It's driving our consciousness to redefine who we are and to understand that who we are is our intrinsic value and our need for meaning and our drive for purpose and a higher connection. Okay, that's how it works. The consciousness of emotion, which is self-centeredness, as we said before, is rooted in the animal soul and therefore just seeks pleasure. Our consciousness of intellect, which is to look objectively at who we are, to redefine who we are, in our mind at least, is driven by the godly soul. Our real soul, and brings purpose as opposed to pleasure. Right? Now, pleasure is not a bad thing necessarily, but the pursuit of pleasure as a goal in itself, as we spoke many, many times, is a problem. Okay. So now the question is, how do we reach that? How do we make sure that it's our soul driving the consciousness and not our animal soul? And here's the problem. The problem is that our animal soul is stronger. Not higher, not deeper, not holier, but more powerful. Why? Because animals are stronger than human beings. Right? If you get chased by an elephant, you're in trouble. Putting it more in a sophisticated language, emotion is stronger than intellect. It should be driven and controlled by intellect, but it's stronger than intellect. Okay? Therefore, it is very hard to stop the rush and the impulse of that subconscious ego driving our emotion, driving our feelings of insecurity, driving our feelings of egocentricity. Very, very difficult. We have to engage in a behavior or behaviors that allow us to do that. Again, going back to the principle we started with. This is all very good in theory and we can think about it from today to tomorrow, but how do we get to feel it? How do we switch that mindset? We have to engage in behaviors that will do that because behaviors are very powerful because the heart follows the action. And the behavior that will allow us to do that is self-control. In two ways. Because there are two things, there are two areas of life which we're going to talk about that get us messed up in this whole process. One is the things we come into contact with, the things we gain pleasure from or not pleasure from. And the other is the relationships that we have. So let's talk about on those two levels. So the first thing is the concept of delayed gratification. Yeah? Not so common today. We don't live in a world of delayed gratification. This is very difficult. That's why what I'm talking about now is so important. Because we're an incredible me world. We become a very incredibly self-centered world. Everything is about I. Everything's about me. It's got to talk to me. It's got to sit with me. It's got to sit well with me. Right? We're living in a society where people are taking themselves very, very seriously. They're in the opposite direction of what we're talking about. Which is why sometimes it's a very empty world. It's lack of purpose, lack of meaning, lack of depth. Right? And in that chapter where, this is her chapter, the chapter of, I think her name is Elaine again, Elaine Cohen, right? In the chapter where she talks about delayed gratification, she says that we have to always ask ourselves a question. How do I live? Am I avoiding pain or living with purpose? Right? That's two perspectives. That comes from the two perspectives. If it's outside in, then I'm always going to live with just avoiding pain, making sure you're okay with me, making sure that I'm taking care of, making sure I feel good. It's all about me. Right? It's outside in. It's what Freud calls the pleasure principle. Just the only problem with Freud was, as I've spoken to you many times about, is that he thought that was the fundamental driving force of the human being. And it was very difficult to overcome that. The good news is that it isn't. Because at the end of the day, the ego in us is very strong and it's maybe more powerful than the soul, but the soul is higher and the soul ultimately is much more infinite, much more permanent and much stronger if we can just tap into it, right? So when we want to become instantly satisfied the entire time, what that means is that we're not stepping back to think about the purpose. We're not thinking about what's meaningful in life. Right? But as soon as we encounter something that feels good, tastes good, or is a good experience or pleasurable experience, we want to engage in it right away. Now we know that delayed gratification, and now with studies, we've talked about the study before, the marshmallow studies and other studies, delayed gratification is now being proven to be directly linked to the most effective and successful people. Right? Because ultimately, the short-term transient pursuit of pleasure and lack of self-control just enforces and continuously enforces the outside-in model. And the outside-in model breeds emptiness because at the end of the day, as we've spoken about many times, pleasure doesn't bring happiness. Pleasure doesn't bring self-contentment. Pleasure doesn't bring a feeling of inner fulfillment. And every human being has a soul. We might not be tapped into it. We might be tapped into our ego more than our soul. Could be. But we have a soul, and that soul is, at the end of the day, the true essence of who we are. And that soul, as Viktor Frankl points out, and as we've talked about how it's so rooted in Jewish thinking, that soul yearns, needs, and is driving us way back in the background to achieve meaning, to achieve purpose, to connect to something higher, to go beyond ourselves, to expand, to grow, to live, to improve ourselves and the world. And you can only do that with an outside-in model. You can only do that by going beyond yourself and leaving yourself alone because you're secure within yourself, because you know your intrinsic value. You just want to use that value now to create the reality on the outside. And when we don't do that, when we engage in lack of self-control, we're just reinforcing it. We can come to 10 discussions about how our true self-value comes from inside, but then if we don't exercise any self-control, our behavior is not matching our mindset. When our behavior doesn't match our mindset, the heart follows the behavior, in the negative as well as the positive. So when we continuously engage in lack of self-control, we're just reinforcing the outside-in model. We're reinforcing the self-centeredness. We're reinforcing the self-absorption. We're reinforcing the pleasure principle. And we're becoming more obsessed with gaining things and pleasure and less happy. That's how it works, unfortunately. Adam and Eve, this was the number one and first failing of human history, where they were asked by God just to stay away from two trees for 3 hours. That's it. And couldn't do it. The reason why I thought about it, it's not the book. The reason why I just thought about it this morning, actually, as I was preparing the shiur, I was looking over the notes, is I just got an email. I wrote an article about this, one of my weekly articles, and some of the articles are published on a website called Chabad.org. And whenever there's a comment, so I get So I get emailed a comment. So this morning when I check my emails, a comment from me says, Rabbi Grari, someone's read the article and says, what's the source for it that it was only for 3 hours? And that after 3 hours when Shabbat would come in, they would be able to eat the fruit. So for a moment I panicked. Like, where is the source? I didn't remember. I know I'd written about it and I'd spoken about it, so I must have found it somewhere. Anyway, thank God I found it. No, because you don't want to say the wrong thing, you know what I'm saying? I always thought, that's for sure, I remember that. It's only for 3 hours, and by the time Shabbos would have come there. And I realized where I'd learned it, so I went looking for it and I found it. No, I found it, it's based on a medrash, but it's brought in Hasidic philosophy, it's brought in a book called Likutei Torah by the author of the Tanya, the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe. So he brings his medrash and explains it and so on. And the reason I found it is because it has to do, I'm just as a side point, it has to do with the mitzvah, because I remember it had to do with the mitzvah of Orlo. There's a mitzvah we have in the Torah where God commands us not to eat the fruit of a tree for the first 3 years, right? Which I know where that verse is, it's in Parashat Kedoshim in Chumash. But I remember that explanation was linked because one of the reasons that God gave us this mitzvah is the 3 years correspond to the 3 hours that Adam wasn't allowed to eat the fruit. And it's a tikkun, it's to train us that, no, that's the first failing of the human being, right? Because what actually happened, you see, that's the point. There's nothing wrong in enjoying God's world. When we talk about not pursuing pleasure, we don't mean abstinence. That's not a Jewish principle. It's a means to an end sometimes, but it's not fundamentally a Jewish principle because God gave us the world to use. And therefore, the fruit of the tree is there to use, as was the fruit in the Garden of Eden. It was there to use, but use for a purpose, to use properly, to use in a way where it assists us to gain meaning, to use it with a focus. And in fact, in the story of Adam and Eve, it was going to be used, because according to many opinions, it was a grape, and it was going to be used for the Shabbat Kiddush. That was its original purpose. Now, there's nothing wrong in having a good wine for Shabbat Kiddush, don't get me wrong, right? I think I've told this before, I don't want to break anyone's misconceptions, but you don't have to have sacramental sweet wine for Kiddush, even though it says on the label Kiddush wine. You can have any kosher wine, and there's some very good kosher wines in the market, right? But it's making a bracha before. It's understanding who created this grape. It's eating with restraint. It's remembering that the reason that we eat is to be healthy so that we can do good things in the world. We can serve God and bring meaning and purpose to our existence. That's what, right? Nothing wrong in enjoying the Shabbat meal, but it's got to be with some focus. So therefore, God gave them the ability. He says, don't eat it for 3 hours so that you can wait. So that you can reflect on why you're going to eat in the first place. It's going to be connected with some holy experience, the Shabbat meal. And they didn't. They pursued pleasure. Yeah.
Rabbi, if it was meant to be used as wine, it would have taken at least 3 hours to turn the grape into wine.
Okay, so the Talmud says that you don't have to do that. You can, as we do today, a lot of people make kiddush and grape juice. You can just take grapes and squeeze them into a cup and make kiddush. I guess just before Shabbat, they'd have to squeeze the grapes. Yeah, that's true. So that, I guess God would have, if they would have held themselves back before Shabbat, God would have said, squeeze them and you make kiddush. I suppose. Although maybe not, maybe Shabbat wasn't given as a mitzvah yet, it was just more the experience. I don't know. All right. So the concept is, so this is a very, very ancient concept, right? This is in the root of Jewish thinking. Why? Because delaying gratification is actually the window into tapping into who we really are. It's the window to switch our mindset from outside in to inside out. In other words, when we behave in a way where we delay gratification and we train ourselves not to connect to something instantaneously just because we want it, we're training ourselves not to live a life where everything is about making sure that my animalistic part of me is taken care of right away. And it reminds us, trains our mind to think like that, that it's not about my instant pleasure. It's about something deeper, which means I have to switch and now go from inside out. So why do I want this? Is it necessary? Is it healthy for me? Is it beneficial? Is it going to support my life of meaning and purpose? Takes us back inside out rather than outside in. Which, as I said, is a concept which I think in our generation is incredibly challenging. Now, we know that we have lots of issues nowadays around this area, right? both with the young and those who aren't so young. I mean, my background is education. I'm still involved in education, and from time to time, as I see things evolve and change. And the sad truth is, sometimes we want to hide from it, but the sad truth is that it's out of control at the moment, right? School kids, high school kids today are out of control. We can pretend it's not that way, but it is that way. The substance abuse, the drinking, other stuff, promiscuity, lots of stuff. It's at their fingertips, in the phone, it's right there, they can access it. It's out of control, right? And it's things which we need to really address, because it's out of control, not because only it's physically unhealthy and potentially dangerous. It's spiritually dangerous, it's psychologically dangerous, it's emotionally dangerous. Because it leads to a life of complete self-absorption and self-centeredness and pleasure-seeking, and therefore leads to a life of emptiness, and unhappiness is on the rise. We know that. Because unhappiness is on the rise, anxiety is on the rise, because that unhappiness brings to anxiety, it triggers all sorts of other emotional and psychological issues, right? And therefore, these kind of things, we've said this long, many, many times, doesn't start by educating people when they're 16 of how bad a drug is. It starts from when kids are 4, training them to have self-restraint, just to delay. You don't really need it now. You'll get it, but not now. Wait half an hour. But the truth is, it doesn't start with the kids at 4 years old. It starts with us. Because as a society, we need to actually create a role model society of delayed gratification. Because we all need to have a hard look at ourselves. We all need to have a hard look at ourselves of how, for example, how addicted we are to our phones, for example, right? We're not, this is not a confession, so we're not going to take any volunteering here, right? But are we okay? Like, do we come home at night and we have a meal with our family, put away the phone? Do we do that? It's fantastic. Some people don't. Many people don't, right? I saw someone told me a story a couple of years ago about friends that for goodness sake, people got to socialize and they don't even socialize properly. I mean, socialize is not a very, very deep spiritual experience. We're just talking about socializing, bonding with people, right? So a bunch of people went out the thing, and they made a thing between themselves. They used to socialize once in a while, that they all put their phones in the middle. And the first person to answer a phone pays for the whole meal for everyone. That's the way you do it. But we have to look at ourselves. We have. Yeah.
If the entire generation of young parents participate in immediate gratification, what chance is there for the next generation?
So I'm a person of tremendous hope. I think God created the world for a reason, and He's going to take care of His world. So I think it's step by step. It's one person at a time making changes. And it will become a trend, because after a while, people will see how bad it is. There's going to be, and it's already starting to happen. I just bought a book, and maybe it'll be the subject of one of the series next year. A very famous author, and I've forgotten his name now. He's written a few bestsellers, and he doesn't have Facebook, and he doesn't have social media, and he's an amazingly successful person, and he's now starting to lecture and talk about this and train people of how to move away from that, right? In other words, we have to, not that there's anything wrong with technology, it's amazing stuff, but we have to learn how to control it rather than controlling us. And it is, so I agree with you, it is very scary, and I think we need to make a revolution, actually. I've started thinking about it. I'm involved a little bit in different educational things, and I think it's something we need to start forcing parents to get involved, at least to have the conversation. Just to open up the eyes for them to actually realize what's going on. And then maybe we need some scare tactics. I don't know. I'm just saying. But yeah, things need to shift. I'm hopeful they will shift, because I think people will start realizing this doesn't work anymore. And look for alternatives. But it is scary. Yes, absolutely. But we've got to be optimistic. So we've got to also believe in the power of one individual. Right? When you go home and we ourselves make a resolution that we're going to put away our phones for 2 hours at night and connect with the family, and then we say, well, what difference is going to make? The whole world isn't going that way. That's not true. Because that's fundamental to our belief system. In Jewish writing, we have all this, that one step in the right direction of one person is contagious, spiritually contagious, physically contagious, and it's powerful. It generates energy into the world. So we have to be optimistic. We have to hope. That's why we have to keep talking about it. Bring another friend to next Thursday morning. So we have to look at it. I'm just saying, are we talking about the topic? We have to look at our own eating habits. We have to look at our own pursuit of materialism and our own phone usage and so on and so forth. We have to create a culture of length. And one of the ways we do that is not by transforming overnight. I always say this, as you know, right? But if you want to engage in a behavior, which will connect us with our inner self value, we have to take one or two things and say, I'm going to delay that gratification. I'm going to put away the phone for half an hour. There's a particular food I love and I'm not going to eat it, at least for the first couple of hours every day, right? Or something. We have to just start getting into the habit of forcing ourselves to delay pleasure. That's a very powerful thing. It's a very defined behavior, and we just have to get into that habit. Yeah.
So I feel like delaying pleasure and trying to manage ourselves in this way is hard work.
Yep.
And I think that we've got so many different areas that we need to try and practice this in, whether it's for everyone's different.
Yep.
So many.
Right.
And I just wonder, the work of it all, even when if you pick two things, I guess I'm wondering, is there space for us to let go in some areas and just focus and have delayed gratification, have control or discipline in 90% of our spaces, and just not really think about the 10%?
Yeah, no. So I think the answer to that is, yeah, I wouldn't consciously say that I'm going to be an animal in 10% of my life. I would just say I'm not going to work on that 10% for now, because we always have to. Yeah, we have to take baby steps. The baby steps have to be in context of a destination. So the destination is we should be in full control.
Is that possible?
No, it's not. But that's the goal we work towards. And then it always works like that. We have to have the ideal goal, which none of us, perhaps maybe only a few very special people reach there, but at least, so. And when we engage in this, we do, you're right. We have to take one or two things that we're going to work on, because it breeds more. In other words, self-discipline breeds self-esteem, it brings self-worth, and it makes it easy then to grow. We have to continuously grow, but it's hard, yeah, of course it's hard work. Very, very hard work, but critical.
Prioritize,
correct. Yeah, and it might be, maybe, exactly. So it might be picking one or two things that are more important than others, not worrying about that 10% or 20% or 30% even, but still knowing that that's the ideal, and that's fine. You know, we're not there to become transformed overnight. Just very quickly, then, the second area of this whole concept is the way we relate to other people. It's the same idea, but this is in the chapter, and this is a concept we've done many, many times. I'm going to go through it quickly, but it's what we call the power of space. Oops. Okay. Right. And it's the self-control, which is not delayed gratification, but it's delayed responses to other people, particularly. Right. And very, very simply, the way it works is like this. Huh? The pause, exactly. Stephen Covey's pause, really comes from Viktor Frankl. Really, it comes from Adam and Eve, from the Torah, from Talmud, and so on. Right? But this is the way it works, and this is a very, very simple formula. This is what we have to bear in mind. That every time we interact with someone, there's an event. So the story he gives is like a couple are washing the dishes, and the wife says to the husband, you know, this dish is still dirty. So he says, well, wash it yourself if you don't want it, right? Why did he respond to that? Because it's an outside-in model. You're threatening me. You're criticizing me. Why couldn't he just say like, oh yeah, I didn't realize. I'll wash it again. Or I'm sorry. I didn't, you know. Or even if he doesn't think it's particularly dirty still, but in his wife's standards it is. So what I'm saying, we all do this in different ways. The reason is because the outside model is we get threatened right away. So our impulses, which works faster than our intellect, as we said before, works quicker and we respond angrily, right? But the way it works is because there's an event. They're washing the dishes. There's a judgment. We judge the person. Why do you say that you're threatening me? Therefore, there's the feeling that comes with the judgment. The feeling is I'm angry. I feel put down. I feel criticized. And then, of course, then there's the space, and then there's a response. So the feeling we'll always have. That doesn't matter. But the power here is the power of space. I'm just going to read you his the way he describes it, because it's very beautiful. He says that the space, a powerful space, exists between our feelings and our response. In this moment, which only needs to last a few seconds or less, we have the opportunity to consider whether our judgment is absolute truth or a defensive, biased story. This space allows us to ask ourselves questions like, is my interpretation true? Even if my interpretation is true, why does it concern me so deeply? Does this event define my worthiness, right? So the behavior that we're talking about here is really a simple, but again, hard work behavior. It's committing, and maybe it's only committing for an hour a day initially, maybe just for a small, maybe it's one person even, right? That every time I have a feeling of anger, or just to give ourselves a space to think, just to give ourselves 10 seconds before we respond.
Count to 10.
Count to 10, right? It might even be that the response that follows afterwards is still not appropriate, but it doesn't matter. In other words, but the chances are it will change dramatically, because it's the power of that few seconds, the power of that space. That's when we can, because our response, which without a space, is an emotional response. An emotional response is linked to our ego, right? That's what we spoke about before. It's linked to our self-centeredness. It's linked to the outside in model, and that's where we're going to respond. Committing to have self-control in the sense in relationships, to just have a space, just clench your fists and have a space, will give us the time. Think about, hold on a second, maybe there's a different way of looking at it. Is it worth responding like that? Is that really what was meant? Or maybe even it'll lead to just responding softly rather than angrily, even if it's something negative, like saying, that was very hurtful. But that's much better than screaming and shouting. Right? So it's that space that is a behavior which then links us and shifts us from the emotion to the intellect, from the ego to the soul, from the outside in to the inside out. So just in summary, therefore, we're the purpose of this discussion is the most critical part of foundational part of living, which is, do we live outside in or inside out? The way we have to do it, once we understand the concept, as we did 2 weeks ago, is to identify behaviors. And today, the behavior is hard work, but it's powerful behaviors. So maybe what we need to do on a very practical level, we need to actually sit down and think about areas in our life where we can just delay gratification, even if we're going to have the gratification, just to delay it, to train ourselves to have that delay, and that self-control similarly to be expressed in, to pick some area in life where we know there's a possibility for negative responses to other people, to commit to engaging in the space. Because that space is very powerful, and those two things, that self-controlled behavior, shifts us from outside in to inside out. Some more thoughts over the next 2 weeks. In the meantime, have a wonderful week.